And you are tuned to Bathrobe Spears Broadsides in beautiful Santa Cruz for the next 3 hours. Should you be interested in joining us, and our show is concerned with civil rights for the poor, civil rights for the homeless, civil rights for anybody, actually, but particularly for people on the streets, this is your show, and we want you to call in. Call-in number, as usual, is 427-3772 or 427-FRSC, Free Radio Santa Cruz. Well, looking in the next room, we have our first guest, actually perhaps our last guest, but certainly our guest of the moment, Renegade Richard Quigley, who's stamping out a cigarette and stalking into the studio even as we speak in his United States Freedom Fighter t-shirt. I believe that Freedom Fighter t-shirt is from the 1990 or thereabouts, or is this a more recent model, Richard?
No, I think I started making these in 1990, thereabouts.
I remember another t-shirt you made at that time, Fuck War.
Oh, yeah, well, that one got me thrown out of the flea market for life. I've been banned for life from the drive-in flea market down there. Actually, they never saw that one. The one they saw was War Sex, but it offended the shirts that their security guys were wearing. It's something about Desert Storm, We Kicked Ass. I think that's what they had. And they came parading up there with a wall full of Desert Storm, We Kicked Ass t-shirts and told me that I couldn't sell War Sex t-shirts at their flea market. Which I guess that's okay. It's their theater.
I don't know. I was outraged when I heard it. I thought it was a clear violation of basic free speech rights and, you know, however you want to call it, private property. It's a public place that people are using. And I first met you, though, to get back to where we began, when I ran into you outside the courthouse in 1989 in the summer. You were at a table defending and gathering signatures for convicted soup distributor Sandra Loringer, an antique merchant and a homeless activist downtown who was being tried for serving food without a permit in Santa Cruz at the town clock.
As a matter of fact, speaking of t-shirts and Sandra Loringer, I still have that artwork. We printed a lot of shirts that year that we took from her trial. When she was on trial, she was standing in front of Attic. Standing in front of Attic.
It's judge, municipal court judge Attic.
Yeah, and it was a sentencing hearing. And he was discussing, you know, what it was that her options were. And he had offered her the opportunity to obey all laws or do 45 days in jail, as I remember. And anyone who hasn't seen this woman, she's just a little whip, tiny little woman standing there. I mean, physically, spiritually, she was bigger than the building she was in. But she stood there in front of the judge and all her might and glory stood there. And I believe the exact quote was, let me see if I understand the conditions of probation or I must obey all laws. There's at least one law in the books that I cannot obey. If feeding people is a crime, I am beyond rehabilitation. And I took I Am Beyond Rehabilitation and immediately slapped it on a commemorative t-shirt of her effort and her sacrifice. She will always be, for me, one of the more special people that I've had the opportunity to meet in this restoration movement.
Yeah, well, we're going to be talking later today about the government of Northern California, city of Arcata's recent attempt and intention of cracking down on food servers up there in that small burg just north of Eureka. We've heard, I've heard both on the phone, I'm going to play you a bit of an interview later in the show, and also on the email coming across the computer, that the authorities in Arcata have put an injunction into place, a preliminary injunction barring Food Not Bombs in Arcata from serving free food to the homeless, yet they have nonetheless serve people daily downtown in the plaza, apparently feeding 30 to 50 hungry people every day, and as a consequence, encouraging the transient problem as the city mothers and fathers see it. So police have been videotaping Arcata Food Not Bombs. police have been, they've served four or five Food Not Bombs members, and they're going to drag them into court, apparently, according to the reports I'm receiving, and they're going to attempt to give them 5 days in jail per incident of food served, which could be up to about 3 months, considering the number of times served. That will happen on November 7th, around 8:30 in Arcata, California, and I'm hoping to get together a caravan of cars to head north. So if anybody is interested in this particular issue, do give a call to 427-3772 while we're on the air, or to Food Not Bombs at 425-3345, or to me at HUFF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, 423-HUFF. Number of numbers for you. But the number to call while we're on the air if you want to discuss or add to or disagree with these issues is 427-FRSC, 427-3772. So, yeah, that's where I first met you. That's where you first met me. That's where we began this beautiful relationship. But since then, you've been engaging in all kinds of other struggles in the court system, ranging all the way from helmet law to your most recent court battle, which I saw a brief bit of yesterday, involving your struggle to make sure the DMV doesn't remove everybody's rights all at once. You want to give us some of the background on your most recent struggle, or do you want to give us a little more historical background? Why don't I let you do what you feel most appropriate here?
Well, yeah, ever since I was a young man, I've been dealing with this automobile situation and the use of automobiles, because I'm at that line where I'm not homeless, but I'm not well-funded, I guess is the best way to describe it. So like many Californians, and I mean millions, I've had trouble maintaining a valid driver's license, and it doesn't have to do with my driving skills, because there's no question that never been in any wrecks. I don't get moving violations, drunk or reckless driving. None of that stuff's ever been associated with any charges against me. Not buying insurance, unable to maintain current registration, all this type of stuff I do encounter. And so through this battle, I've gone to a lot of sources, and I've listened to a lot of people talk, and I've seen a lot of different approaches. Everything from changing your status as a citizen, trying to invoke the right to use the roadways and so on. And I've taken a line on this that I think is going to be, I'm confident in it, but I think it's going to be successful. It's based on some pretty basic principles of law that the courts today are acknowledging. So at least I'm working in an area where sometime in the last 50 years they've said, yeah, that's right. One of them is under Miranda. Miranda points out that no one can legislate away a right. If you have a right, you will have that right for always and ever. I mean, as a public, we will have these rights.
The Miranda decision, for those who don't know, is a Supreme Court decision from the mid-60s, which fundamentally gave people the right to hear from police officers when they were being arrested, that they had the right to remain silent, that they had the right to have a counsel appointed for them, or to retain an attorney if they wish. And I think there may have been a third statement.
There's several things in the Miranda decision. It's what they call a landmark decision. In other words, everything post-Miranda was certainly different than everything that was happening before it. But one of the key elements that I draw on is this thing about you can't legislate away a right. Now, there was a time in this country when there was no question as to whether or not people had the right to use the roadways in the manner to which they had been adapted and devoted. And this is, by the way, very important language when I'm dealing with these issues, because public property is just that. It is the property of the public. It is held in trust by the state, whether it be the roadways that constitutes the public property, or a park downtown, or any public property. And that use in the manner to which it's been adapted and devoted pertains to schools, parks, public buildings, and the roadways. And what the state has done is joined with the insurance industry in extorting the use of the public trust in which the roadways are held. But if you back up, before this became fashionable and a means of funding the government, you'll find that the right to use those roadways was extremely well protected. In fact, even today, it's interesting that I live on a three-mile stretch of private road. Past the point where I leave public road, I have 3 miles of private road. and the law that protects my right to use that private road, this is just incredible. I mean, I can't be licensed, I can't be detained, I can't be bothered in any way by anyone who actually owns that road. I am a property renter up there. I do not have a property interest in that roadway, but I do have the right of easement. And that easement is what I'm arguing for in relation to public roads. In any case, unless I do something that creates a damage by my use of that private road, the people that actually do own that road, private citizens, cannot keep me from using it. And yet, when I get to the end of that private road and get onto the public road in which I do have a property interest, I'm told that I'm not allowed to use it except and unless I get permission from somebody. And so I'm trying to get the law to sit there and recognize the fact that they're sitting there singing out of both sides of their mouth. And another interesting angle that I'm taking that I'll get to toward the end is that all the public roadways were built from land acquired by eminent domain. And the legal foundation of eminent domain is the right of the public. So that,
explain what eminent domain is.
Well, that's when the right of the public allows the government to step in and take private holdings and put them to public use. And the legal foundation for that, again, as I point out, is that the public need. So that the need to drive through your yard for the public by way of a street or a highway is seen under eminent domain to supersede your right not to have somebody driving through your yard. So that this whole thing about easement and the right to travel and so on comes down into this area of eminent domain. Well, all the highways are built on land acquired by eminent domain, which means that they had to invoke the right of the people to use this property for all manners of travel. And then they turn around on the other hand and they want to tell you that that use is a privilege. Now, either they've got to start giving a lot of land back because they obtained it under fraud, or they've got to get off this notion that we have to be licensed in order to use that property. License being conferring a privilege that isn't a right.
So one of your major concerns and contentions is that the whole DMV operation, which requires you to have a driver's license, is in fact somewhat bogus.
Well, I have no problem with reasonable regulation, and I think that that's what we're going to end up talking about in my case. And it's going to be kind of funny because anybody that's ever dealt with a bureaucracy as a citizen knows that our idea of reasonable and their idea of reasonable are just miles apart. But reasonable regulation, do I think that society has a right to expect that the people that use the roadways by automobile at least have some knowledge about how to operate that automobile in a way that doesn't cause them to go crashing into people? And reasonable regulations as to people going down the road, everybody stays to the right, you know, except to pass and stuff like that. I mean, the basic rules of the road are not a problem for me. But when they come in and they start imposing requirements that you contract into submissions to blood tests, you waive your right against unreasonable searches and seizures by having to agree to take these blood tests at the whim of some cop, you have to provide social security numbers, you have to, you know, it's this whole process of contracting as a condition of this license is where they fall apart.
Now, actually, you are referring to the form that you sign when you seek to get a driving license?
Yeah, it says application on the top, which is typical bureaucratic BS, because in fact, an application is when one seeks to contract. In other words, you apply to contract. The contract, the nature of a contract, yeah, in law is that it changes the legal relation between two parties. Now, currently, for example, I'm under no obligation to take any blood tests by the demand of any cop or the Department of Motor Vehicles. If I were to complete this so-called application and sign my name to it and hand it to them, that legal relation would change. Suddenly, I would have an obligation to do that I had promised to do that I'd signed my name to.
Because on the form, it specifically states that you agree to that condition as a condition of receiving that license.
That's correct. So that's the condition which they, and that changes the legal relation. The other side of my signature, they can then demand what would otherwise be an unreasonable search or seizure. And you don't have to waive one right to exercise another. So I'm bringing all these issues up slowly. I'm doing it in a different way than it's been done before. One thing that I've discovered in dealing with the courts is that the answer you get has a lot to do with how you phrase the question. And I'm dealing with a situation here where the government will acknowledge that the roadways are held in trust, that the government is the trustee in that trust, and that the public are the beneficiaries. It is my contention, and will ultimately be my legal argument, that these people are plundering that trust, in fact, are guilty of stealing the private property contained in that, or the public property contained in that trust from the public.
Let me interrupt you for a moment, Richard, and again, tell the audience that, invite you listeners, if you want to call in and debate with Richard, ask him a question or two, or commend him for his good work, the number to call is 427-3772 here. We do have an open line. I am keeping my eye on the phone, so do give us a call. Just to stir up the pot a little bit here, so are you saying that aren't blood tests and such like mandatory requirements a proper way of dealing with the increasingly difficult problem of accidents caused by drunk driving?
Well, first of all, 99% of the drunk driving arrests have nothing to do with any property damage. So if you start arresting people on the speculation as to what they might do under any given circumstance, and then you're just opening the door. The underlying theme to this whole behavior is that the end justifies the means.
So you're saying most people who are taken on drunk driving charges have not hurt anyone or caused any property damage?
And chances are they aren't going to. The interesting thing about a drunk driving laws is that they rely on the level of alcohol content in your blood when you're unable to comfortably operate a driving simulator. In other words, they take these people and they sit them down stone sober at the simulator and say, okay, operate the simulator. And then they start feeding them alcohol. And they keep track of their alcohol blood level when they start to get to where they can't effectively, I guess is the line that they draw, operate that simulator. And this whole thing is supposed to somehow or other stand in place of operating an automobile. Now the problem is that you have no way to measure an alcohol-impaired driver against one who simply got their head up their ass. I would rather be on the road in most cases with somebody that might be a .08 or some other ridiculous number who has got both hands on the wheel, eyes wide open, and they know that their reflexes are somewhat impaired by the alcohol, therefore they are being very careful. I would prefer that they don't have to drive 55 on the freeway to avoid a citation for driving 50, for example, where they might feel safer. Anyway, the comparison's not valid. Most accidents are caused because people are not paying attention, and so you got somebody out there that's a lot more dangerous putting on their makeup on the way to work or trying to read the newspaper while they're going over Highway 17 or, you know, read a fax and talk on the phone while they're moving across town. This is the kind of behavior that causes people to be distracted. Accidents happen when people stop paying attention to what they're doing.
Well, in other words, the claims that many accidents are alcohol-related, you feel is a false one.
Well, it's the insurance industry. The insurance industry rules the highways. And that whole dynamic is a show in itself, but essentially what it comes down to is first they insure you against losses during the use of automobiles, and then on the backside they convince the legislature to come in and remove all the risk to protect their investment. So at the same time that they're insuring against wrecks and accidents and stuff by taking in a pool of money from which they dispense funds, they are also spending a ton of that money taking away any possibility that anything could happen to you. So it's...
Now, how do they take away that possibility again?
No, they just get you off the road. They say, you know, well, you drank this much, you're done. Your car's not in new condition, you're done. There's a million and one ways that they take away your right to use the roadways.
You smoked a joint 3 months ago.
Oh, God. One of the more ridiculous ones has to do with the effect of marijuana. I mean, I've always thought that marijuana made me much better driver. I'm sitting at a four-way stop, you know, and I'm loaded. I don't know what everybody else is like, but I'm looking there and say, yeah, go ahead. You know, I'll pull out in a minute as soon as I'm sure everything's all right. A little bit of paranoia, I think, is good for drivers. I prefer to see if I can't encourage people to be paranoid when they're out there in a $3,000 or $4,000 machine tripping down the road at 65, 70 miles an hour. I think paranoia should be the absolute prevailing mentality.
Now, let's get up to the present here. Let's jump to the case that you're currently enmeshed in. Can you give us a sort of a brief factual background as to, you know, how this all came about? And, well, go for it.
Okay, there's a law in the books in California that says that when a clerk of a court reports to the Department of Motor Vehicles that you failed to appear on a ticket that you signed, that they then suspend your license. In my case, I got stopped in 94 in Concord, California. I had a cop stand there telling me I was either going to sign this ticket or he was going to take me to jail. So it was clear that he wasn't going to operate within the law. I did, in fact, write my name at the bottom of that ticket. I didn't sign anything, by the way, but I wrote my name at the bottom of that citation to avoid the incarceration. I was on my way and had some business to take care of and didn't have time to deal with this idiot.
So you feel that signing a ticket is not a mandatory process that, or should not be a mandatory process?
Well, no. When I get stopped by a police officer, if I have time to play the game, because they don't understand the rules, don't care, the rules get in their way, but Vehicle Code 40302C says that that when you're in a situation where you're stopped by a police officer alongside the road, you have a right to demand to be taken immediately to a magistrate to have a probable cause hearing as to the arrest. And it's kind of interesting when I deal with these guys when we go down that road how they react to that. They don't care about Vehicle Code 40302C. They got the ones that say that I'm supposed to do this and I'm supposed to do that, but this one says that they're supposed to do something, so they don't want to talk about that. So you usually end up going to jail. But you don't have any obligation to sign that ticket unless you agree to all the terms and conditions. And when you start reading that, you'd be just like anybody else. I mean, signing anything that the bureaucracy has printed, is I recommend against it almost and without exception. Signing this one has proven to be a real pain. Because, of course, I served it back on the officer within an hour. I had a guy out there on a motorcycle, and this cop was stopping somebody else. And my buddy walks up and hands a ticket back to the guy, and I had written across the face of it, refused for cause, without dishonor, which is a UCC thing, pretty complicated. But
UCC means?
Commercial code is a CC. I think it's universal, but I don't remember. I don't know.
Part of the legal code?
Yeah. Anyway, it's just refusal because the signature was extorted, and the ticket should have died there, but now they sent it to the court. Court expected me to show up. They got the distinct impression looking around that I hadn't, and so they notified the Department of Motor Vehicles that there had been a failure to appear under the provisions, again, of the vehicle code. I went into court. Then the DMV notified me they were going to suspend my license. I wrote them a letter and said, excuse me, I know some clerk over there told you that I didn't appear, but whether or not I factually appeared is not relevant. It's whether or not there is a judgment against me, a finding of a court that I did not appear, which means due process, a trial, some sort of hearing on the matter, and a determination by a judge, not some clerk's assertion. And I'd appreciate it if you wouldn't suspend my license. They give me the single-digit salute and move forward. So I went into court to have the suspension removed from my license, and that was what I was in there talking about the judge with yesterday. Can they move on the bare allegation of a court clerk to take away a property right? Now, the fight for the license is interesting.
The property right they'd be taking away would be?
My driver's license. I was getting to that.
And why would that be a property right?
Well, the courts have already established that. They like that. And I'm sitting there willing, I'm more than willing to accept their terminology in that regard for now. I am fighting literally today for the right to a driver's license because the courts have acknowledged and will acknowledge that you have a right to a license, which is almost a conflict in terms when you consider that a license is permission to do something which you wouldn't otherwise have a right to do.
What about the phrase driving privileges, which has cropped up recently?
Well, it is a privilege to use the roadways, but only for commercial purposes. In other words, if you're hauling something or someone for money, it's only reasonable that the public who own the highways, have built and maintained the highways, impose some sort of tax or benefit for the use of that roadway for commercial purposes. In other words, yeah, let's move it to something that people would more easily understand. A community park down here. If you wanted to go in and open a hot dog stand, I don't think it's unreasonable that somebody should require that you get a permit to make money off of a public land to help cover the cost of cleaning up after you and stuff like that. Now, as far as somebody wanted to go out and hand free food out, since that's not a commercial venture, then we're back to, the government's got no business being involved in that, and is it not a proper place? That whole thing breaks down real quick. But that same deal with the roadways. If you're out there making money using the roadways, then I think it's reasonable, and it's long been established. I mean, we're talking about the length of time that our country's been around, that when you haul something or someone for money on public property, that the public has a right to charge fees necessary to compensate them for the obstruction of their free travel, the damage that might be caused, wear and tear to the roadway, et cetera, and reasonable regulation. But that has nothing to do with using the roadway for non-commercial purposes like, getting from one place to another. I've kind of laughed at the fact that we have driving as a privilege. We have this whole transportation system set up so that we literally have to have a car to survive in California. The planning department and building departments of the counties will not allow businesses next to housing areas, next to shopping areas, so walking from one place to another, from your home to your work or from your work to the stores, is ridiculous. You can't do it. They don't have a public transportation system that will accommodate it. So at the same time, they're making everything by design being spread out to where you have to have a car to get there. They're claiming that you can walk. So every place that you point and go far enough, their arguments fall apart. And what I've got to do in these court cases is take it one step at a time, which is to get to digress for a moment back to where I was going. Fight for this driver's license is just one step in fighting for the right not to have it. Once it becomes clear that I have a right to a license, then I think they're going to be hard-pressed to argue that I have a right to operate that vehicle without the license.
I would like to point out that our listeners have a right to call in at 427-3772 and query Renegade Richard as to just what the Sam Hill he's up to, challenging the long-established traditions of our DMV. So you're claiming that any...
Well, wait a minute. Long-established is kind of a relative term, isn't it? Long established would, for me, reach back to Magna Carta. In Magna Carta, they talked about the right to travel by the use of these roadways and so on. It's so fundamental to the good health of a nation that it wasn't even worth considering that you could limit that in any way. Toll bridges, toll roads, all that kind of stuff was forbidden by Magna Carta. So if we're going to talk about long established, let's talk about long established. Let's back up and say long established is Magna Carta. And then you've got this last 50-year change. So we have this recent change in our fundamental rights, but long-established law protects that right.
Are you claiming then, Richard, that anybody can refuse to sign a promise to appear citation from an officer if they choose?
Don't even talk to them. What I do when I'm stopped by a peace officer is I ask him if I'm under arrest. If he tells me I'm being detained, I ask him what the nature of the crime is. If he doesn't want to talk to me, I dummy up. And as soon as we get to the point where he starts asking for stuff, I ask him whether it's under Terry or under Miranda. Under Terry decision, they got a right to stop me and talk to me, and that's okay to determine whether or not I'm committing a crime. If they want to start questioning me about things they don't know about, that moves into Miranda. And under Miranda, I just look around and say, well, I don't have an attorney present. The questions you're asking me are obviously intended to see if you can't get me in jail.
We're
done until I get in front of a judge.
We have an incoming call. You're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hello, Robert. Hello, Richard. This is someone. Hi.
Hi.
This is Coyle. And I've been trying to call in there. And I wanted to ask Richard about what the law is. If you get pulled over for fix-a-ticket, let's say, like this happened to me, I was in an accident, my car was considered totaled, but it made part of the front bumper stick out too far. So before I could, I didn't have the money to get another car. It was drivable, but I would get tickets for the fender sticking out just a little too far. I mean, you're just supposed to cut it off, bang it off, or if you don't sign the ticket, then what happens?
Well, they take you to jail. What's supposed to happen is that they're supposed to take you. They're supposed to take you immediately to a magistrate. I don't know how many people out there have $3, but if you got $3, take it to the Department of Motor Vehicles. Give it to them for a book, because there's very few books that thickness that aren't worth $3. So that's one of the few things you can get from them that's, I think, worth the money. And under Vehicle Code Section 40302.
What book is that?
The Vehicle Code book.
I got you.
Okay. Anyway, under 40302C, they've got to take you immediately to a magistrate if you demand to do that. And I was going through the process. I'll give you one case. It was about 2 years ago. I'm driving down the freeway, and this lady looks over at a CHP officer, and she recognizes me. And she sort of knows that I don't have a driver's license. And it had come from earlier conversation that she'd been involved with. So she pulls behind me and she turns on her red light. So I just keep driving, figuring we're gonna go for a ways. And so we get down to, I was pulling on the freeway down in Aptos, and I get off on Park Avenue down, pull up the end of the on-ramp. And by this time, she's getting a little bit upset. She's sort of hitting on her siren, and she's yelling at me through the speaker, and my Rottweiler's in the back of my little pickup, and she starts howling. And I got this woman yelling and my dog howling, and I'm looking around. I get to Park Avenue and I turn right and start on up the road there, and she's still back there and she's yelling and the dog's howling, and it's a general scene. And I pull on up to Bay Photo Lab, and I signal and turn left into Bay Photo and pull into the parking lot, and the dog's howling and the woman's yelling at me. Anyway, so I get out of the truck and I lock the truck and I turn around and she's bailing out of this car, and I mean, this is one PO'd cop. And she wants to see my driver's license and registration. I said, excuse me, am I under arrest? Well, no, you're being detained and I need to ask you a few questions. Well, ma'am, if you've got some questions to ask me, what we need to do is we need to load up in your car, shoot on down to the courthouse, let's grab us a magistrate, and we will have a probable cause hearing as to this arrest. Because you're entitled, when you're taken into custody, to a probable cause hearing. She kind of looks at me and she asks me a couple more questions, and I said, ma'am, I don't think you understand. According to Miranda, I have a right to have my attorney present before questioning. You are obviously asking me questions, the answers to which you hope will incriminate me. I'm not saying anything to you at all until there's at least one attorney present, if it's only the magistrate. So either take me downtown or go away and leave me alone. And at this point, she gets her eyes real narrow, and she's just, I mean, she's looking out through them reflective glasses, but I can see because the sun's coming through the cyber eyes, and her eyes are just narrowed down. And she, with her teeth gritted together, she says to me, you think you're real smart, don't you? And I looked that up. I said, no, ma'am, I don't believe I'm smart at all. That's why I'm not answering any more questions till we get to a magistrate. And I just stood there and looked at her. At which point, she got back in the car, turned the lights off, and drove away. I got back in my truck, drove on into town. So that happens. That's one of the better results you can get. Now, if you want to try the one where you stand there and do that and you run into, you know, Billy Badass, he breaks out his club and starts whacking on you, there are stories to back that one up too. But the law requires that when you're under arrest, which you are under arrest when they've got those lights on, when you're under arrest, you have a right to be taken to a magistrate immediately for a probable cause hearing. Not to the jail, not to be fingerprinted, not to be booked, not to nothing. Now, there's a magistrate supposed to be available 24 hours a day. Are there people who have gone back and sued because they lost on this? Yeah. Do the courts demand that the cops follow the law? No. I mean, you know, so it's one of those things which I don't know what your experience is going to be.
And if the magistrate is not available, what do you do?
How could a magistrate not be available? There's a magistrate available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There's no way for them, for example, to pull down an arrest warrant for a murderer if they don't have a magistrate available. There is always a magistrate available.
So when they take you to jail instead, they're violating your constitutional rights. Now that goes into so what if you don't have what it takes to back that up and go down the next road and do all the, I mean, what you have to know about the law to invoke your rights is just unbelievable to me when you compare it with the education that we get about the law when we're in their propaganda centers.
So this actually brings us to another question I wanted to bring up, because you've been involved with a group called the...
Okay, thanks. I'm going to go.
All right, anything, nothing else you want to add, Coral?
I think I'll listen more and be thoughtful.
Okay, thank you.
For the answers, thanks.
All right.
This brings us to the question of the... of how indeed do you educate yourself about these issues which you speak so eloquently, and yet which most people probably have little awareness of, or at least little detailed awareness of. You were working with a group, in fact you were running a group called the Illegal Paralegal Services Club?
Well, the past tense is a little sad to hear, but I'll agree that the Illegal Paralegal Services Club has not boomed the way I hoped it would. What I did was is that I made myself available to a club called just that, illegal being a sick bird, Illegal Paralegal Services Club, and we were having meetings monthly, and we'll pick them up again. We're temporarily without a site to meet, but I still represent these people. There's about 40 people showed up to the first meeting, people that want to find out how to deal with the rights in relation to the roadway. I think probably after the first of the year, we'll start having monthly meetings again, at which I hope to help people not only teach them the things that I've learned, but not knowing it all. And I certainly, I didn't claim to know it all. I do know a lot of stuff, but I don't know it all. That we'll learn together how to use law libraries and how to research cases. A couple of the members of the club currently have cases before the courts that I'm helping them with. I do most of the backup work on it. Kate Wells works with us when we need an attorney present. She's volunteered her time pro bono to help with us. So we've got some of the things in place and we are doing some work. But because of the lack of financial support and a broader base interest, we're sort of kind of putting along right now, trying to get a couple of cases handled, and then we'll come back and start talking about those. But the structure of the organization and is kind of weak. We're a little bit on the weak side today, but there's always hope.
How can folks leave a message for you, or get some information about the club, or express their interest in becoming a part of the club once it renovates and reactivates?
Well, we'll be getting the word out when we start having meetings again. Like I say, I think it'll probably be in January, and by then we'll have at least a couple of court decisions that we can talk about. We need to find a real stable place to meet, where we don't end up in conflict, and the last place we had never really gelled, so I'm taking a long look at how we set that part up. It's also something that I don't have the time to do. I can do the part that I can do, but I can't do it all. I can't arrange the meetings. I can't find the places. I cannot do all I hate to say mundane, but for lack of a better word, the mundane technical stuff that it takes to make an organization go. So there's going to have to come enthusiasm from some other source to kind of bolster it up. There's no way I can carry the load myself. And I think that's really what we're lacking right now is a community enthusiasm for this, which is why I think after we get a couple of cases behind us, we'll get better attention.
Well, actually, and if anyone is interested in the subject, then I find Richard an eloquent and inspirational speaker, if I do say so.
Wow.
Yeah. You can always leave a message for Richard through me at 423-HUFF, my HUFF Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom phone number. And, of course, right now is the time to walk with your fingers to the telephone and give a call to us at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 427-3772. The lines are open. So you have this current court case pending. What's the next step in the court case? When's your next court date? And how can people, tell us that.
There's three cases going. One is mine, and I think that's the one you're talking about. And the next step in that is Judge Stevens told us yesterday that he's going to go ahead and issue an order on that and either grant or deny the writ
to remove this suspension that's based on this allegation that there's no case to support. And I'll get that ruling out of him next week.
This is the suspension based upon the clerk's contention that you did not appear in court.
That's correct.
And you're saying that, no, a clerk's statement is insufficient. You need a judgment by the court.
Yeah, what it is it takes the process out of the due process. We're just working on what they think is due, which is not exactly what I got in mind. So we're discussing whether or not, and that's what the judge is considering now, whether or not there's a process that was left out here, which, by my understanding and by the Founding Fathers' explanation of it, there certainly is. Although I did read a decision that was handed in by the Attorney General who was opposing counsel on it. This is kind of neat. You know, if you sue the government as an individual, a party not trained in the law, what they call pro per, representing yourself, they send the best that the state has to offer. They send the Attorney General's office down with all their resources to pound you into an arena where the judge is obviously, not impartial. He does work for the bureaucracy. And I kind of laugh and wonder how anybody ever expected to get justice out of there anyway. But I play it because it's the only game in town, and I'm into this restoration movement pretty heavy. I think revolution's a little harsh, particularly when we don't have near the guns or the willingness to kill that the people that we're fighting do. So I always thought that revolution's kind of silly, but restoration's a different deal, and it holds a different headspace, and it causes people to deal with you differently. So we are definitely involved in a restoration, but we are not in any way, I'm not certainly promoting any sort of revolution. Anyway, that's the one case. We're trying to decide whether or not a clerk can just go ahead and suspend your license. At the same time that is going on, to talk about the two other cases, we have one case that Kate Wells is handling for a guy that the law is required when you get a traffic ticket, if you request it, they have to generate a complaint from the district attorney's office. And Judge Stevens ruled that wasn't necessary. The appellate courts have ruled in the past that it is, and we're hoping that we can get him to reconsider that so that we can bog the system down with that technicality.
Got an incoming call. We'll talk more about the verified complaint situation after this call.
Hi there, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
I don't want to be on the radio.
You don't want to be on the radio?
No, I just want to tell you guys about an event that's happening.
Okay, well, go ahead. Tell me. Richard, why don't you talk a little bit about that verified complaint?
Yeah, I'll do that. So, anyway, the process by which the court establishes jurisdiction to deal with matters that are dealt with commonly now with tickets is that you have a right to request that the district attorney file a complaint. And that's all been, it's all been sealed in stone. The fact that Judge Stevens is not going with established law is nothing new. I think he just didn't read the brief well enough. But we're moving to have him reconsider that. That system will ensure our rights, and as we get these traffic citations and when we're going to make court appearances, if we ask for these complaints, there's a lot of ways to attack the complaints. So we have to establish in this county that is the process by which the court establishes jurisdiction. If you ask for a complaint and they want to move with the ticket, they're in essence saying that the cop can initiate a criminal complaint, which the concept is ludicrous. So when we get it whipped around to the complaints, where the DA has to generate a complaint in order for the traffic court to get jurisdiction, the DA's not going to want to deal with anything that's not going to generate enough money to cover the expense of the complaint, so most of these petty tickets will go away. Now, the third case that we're working on happens to be in San Benito County, and it's interesting over there, the district attorney understood the law and the courts understood the law, and they actually, on a traffic ticket, generated a bona fide complaint, a criminal complaint, out of the district attorney's office. And then we went back in and argued, okay, you've explained that this guy did not stop at the stop sign. However, you did not explain why that's any of the legislature's business. You haven't established legislative jurisdiction over him. Why? What difference does it make that he didn't stop? In the absence of hitting somebody, why do these laws apply to him? So we're now over there beating that concept around over in San Benito County.
Now, have you, in fact, explained, I was away on the phone here for a moment, Richard, why it is you feel that ordinary traffic laws do not pertain to people unless an accident happens?
Well, they don't. The whole vehicle code was initially written as civil, and it doesn't apply to anyone except people under contract with the Department of Motor Vehicles. And in the true law, in the way that it is written, not as the way it is being applied, The only people obliged to the vehicle code are people that are moving something or someone for money. Now, do the courts recognize this? No. Not at the level you're going to deal with, but do the higher courts recognize it? They always have. So if you can keep the question that you ask on point and the issues on point, and don't let them rephrase your question as you move up through the system, although it will look real bleak just before you get there, when you finally get to the big boys and the appellate and the Supreme Courts of the states and the federal government, you will find that the law that protects your rights to use the roadways are all still in place. But it's a hard struggle, and it's real tough because these guys are skilled at getting the issues off point, at changing the subject matter, at making things different from what they are so that they can capitalize on those holes that they blow in this stuff. So it's a long battle. It's a real educational process.